This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm interviewing Ivy Pakoda, the author of The Art of Disappearing, a new novel. Hi, Ivy.
Hi, David.
How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Good. Now, I know this is your first novel. Can you talk a little bit about what got you to write this book?
There's two, the plot and the impetus to write were two totally different, came from two totally different sources. The reason I started writing the book was I was living in Amsterdam playing professional squash, and I didn't feel entirely satisfied by athletics. I love playing squash, but I thought that the days spent on court were a little bit, at least for me, mindless. So I wanted to find some sort of way to use the time I was spending in Europe to some more, I guess, goal-oriented effect. And so I was going to come back to America, but I started to write instead to see whether that might be some reason that I could elongate my stay.
Well, you know, I typically only interview writers whose books I like. And so I have to say, I thought this book was beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Your writing is really good. And I know some of the people, you know, you get blurbs for every book in advance. And the blurbs talk about the quality of your writing. And I think, you know, I was captured partly by the story, which I think is complicated, has a little element of magical realism. And I guess for people who are listening to this, I will say that it's about, and you can talk about it maybe in your, you know, better than me, but it's about a woman who falls in love with a magician. He happens to be a real magician and not a trickster.
Right.
If you could talk about the writing process. Did you always want to be a writer? Have you been around books?
Well, I grew up around books because my parents are both involved in publishing and editing. And I think I always knew that I wanted to write, but was very hesitant to admit it because coming from my family in which there were books everywhere and the expectation from other people, not from my parents, was to write, I really resisted. I never wrote fiction before I wrote this book. I've never written a short story. Never taken a writing class until recently. I'd written plays and poetry, but deep down, I think it was always, you know, a secret desire. I love to read, and I guess I remember being younger, and my mother asked me, you know, what I wanted to do with my life, and I told her that I wanted a job where I could read all day, and she was not exactly thrilled because it sort of belied a certain lack of motivation on my part, but I think I found that. There was definitely the desire from when I was younger.
So who would be your influences in writing? What writers most appeal to you?
Well, it's changed a little bit now because I've started reading a little more as a writer. When I was writing this book and I decided to use magical realism, which we can talk about later because it was a conflicted decision, the writer who's use of magical realism influenced me most was Murakami, because the success of his novels, at least for me, is predicated on the intense descriptions of reality that are, everything is so clear, the rules of his magical realism are so clearly stated. It's not a lot of, you know, fantasy and magic writing is pulled out of left field. They always invent, the writers often invent too much. And I his use of magical realism was a huge influence on me.
Well, it seemed like for me, clearly I got the magical realism of this, you know, almost immediately because it's a magician.
Yeah.
But I love the idea that with his hands, he can change reality. And that then there comes with that this kind of potential for tragedy. It's this power, but it's not simple. It's not like we imagine, you know, rub the magic lantern and get your wishes. It's much more complicated than that.
Right. And I had to set rules for myself because, you know, he's a magician and he has, his powers extend beyond that of a normal magician, but I couldn't make him omnipotent, you know. I mean, I do sort of state it, I think, in the book that, you know, he can't pull an airplane out of the sky or clean his house or so just to give a sort of sense that his magic is relegated to the stage or to sort of a certain sense of showmanship.
Well, but it's almost he's, because of the nature of our world, he's forced to channel his magic into showmanship.
Absolutely.
And but the your main character who falls in love with him, Mel, and I love, you know, Mel Snow, which is great. She's in the desert and her, you know, her last name.
That was a complete coincidence. So much of
there
this
are
book
no coincidences.
Exactly. But so much of this book seemed to come together after I'd, you know, I noticed that she was in the desert and her name was Mel Snow, and I'd never intended that.
So did you, well, did the book, I mean, every writer has a different story about the way the story worked. Did you map the story out or did it be unfold?
Neither. I didn't map it out, which is something that I hope to do going forward with writing. You know, the problem with writing about a magician who has these certain powers is there's so many potential, there's so many levels you could take it to, and it really took me a long time to figure out what the end goal of his magic was. 'Cause like you said before, there is a certain amount of power or abuse of power that, you know, someone with these capabilities can exert, and I had to figure out how I was going to limit his power. So it took me quite a few tries to get it to an ending that was sort of a synthesis of magic and emotion and power. And so I wrote it, and I rewrote it, and I rewrote it, but there was never a plan until the very end. When I went back and looked at the book, and I pulled out all these elements, like, for instance, her name is one of them, though it's minor, all these coincidences that had come into the novel, or these, I'm not sure, yes, they're not coincidences. And then I realized, I figured out what the most, the natural ending was going to be for my characters, which is not the one I had in mind at all. I was actually upset, I mean, that I wanted them to wind up in a different place, and what I'd written made it impossible for that to happen, which is interesting.
Right, so that the story becomes a power in itself,
yeah.
And it's not necessarily, you know, I think for a lot of writers, the story takes over. The characters take over. I've heard writers talk about the characters inhabiting their imaginations kind of for a long time. Are these characters ones that you feel you need to explore further? Are they going to appear in the future, or do you have, or maybe you don't even know?
I don't think I'll explore them further. It was difficult because I made up everything about them. They're not even remotely like anyone I know. So they're quite exhausting to write about. I mean, you know, now that what I'm working on, I'm not basing it on people I know, but a situation I know, things that are sort of, you know, more within the realm of the everyday, so I can better judge reactions. But these two, Mel and Toby, I found them, I loved them, but it was overwhelming to try to figure out all their moves, all their voices all the time, because they are really sort of, in my mind, they're people who don't live really in the present day. They're sort of in a sort of, I don't know, they're a bit old-fashioned, and even though the novel is set in the recent past.
They do have elements. I actually hadn't thought about that, almost Victorian in their emotional life.
Absolutely.
Which is really interesting. And but, of course, the setting for the book, and I guess, you know, to tell this to people who haven't read it, again, it's not giving it away, the book takes place primarily in Las Vegas, which is, you know, a pretty, I mean, that's a showmanship kind of place. It's like the America. And then it switches to a completely different place, which is Amsterdam. And obviously you were in Amsterdam for a period of time in your life. Did you, where does Las Vegas come into it?
Well, I haven't spent a lot of time in Las Vegas. I mean, I've passed through 5 or 6 times, and I'm always a little bit transfixed by Nevada. I love flying into Las Vegas because it just sort of like pops up out of the desert like a pop-up
book. You see all the lights, it looks like.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I just got an idea for the story, the setting, the opening. I've had it in my mind for a very long time. I would say 10 or 15, no, 10, 12 years maybe. But, you know, I started writing it when I lived in Amsterdam, and it made a lot of sense for my characters to come visit me in Holland. It was also a very useful way for me to sort of, as I said before, you know, translate my experience in Europe right. into something, you know, meaningful, worthwhile. As they get to know the city, I'm getting to know the city. Every situation or every place that they visit in Amsterdam is based on somewhere that I explored and that really influenced me or that was remarkable.
Well, it comes across in your descriptions.
Oh,
they're
great.
Very alive. I guess that was sort of my question about Las Vegas, because your desert descriptions are beautiful, and this place, I mean, again, I don't want to give it away, yeah. but there's a place that they go out in the desert, this house, which was pretty powerful. And I just wondered if they, you know, that you had been to those places or if you just made them up.
Well, the house that they go to is actually, oddly enough, based on a house that I was going to move into when I came back from the Netherlands to New York. I saw this blue ranch house in Park Slope or Kensington, and it was sort of abandoned, and it was just completely out of place in this row of brownstones. And I thought, you know, a lot of their lives are about, you know, things popping up in the wrong places. So that's where that house was. Well, that's what inspired it.
And I guess the other thing I wanted to ask about, I mean, there's characters in the story who are pretty, you know, pretty well drawn. There's the young sort of, again, I don't want to give things away, but there's a young woman mm-hmm. who kind of follows the magician mm-hmm. around and has on a collision course with him that's sort of destiny-driven.
Yeah.
And then there's the woman who hires Mel to keep her in Las
yeah.
Vegas, drawn from your imagination also?
Yeah, absolutely. I do have a pretty profound obsession with teenagers. I love teenagers. I've worked with teenagers recently. I'm really interested in their sort of, you know, single-minded devotion to certain fads. Though this woman, teenager Greta, isn't based on, her name is really weird too. I don't know why she has a German name.
Greta was an odd name, definitely, especially for Nevada, you know, living in the
desert.
Yeah,
the only Greta I know is the secretary at The Nation magazine, so it's sort of weird.
Right, and a 18-year-old or 17-year-old.
Half Native
definitely.
American, half
yeah.
Canadian girl. But she's drawn from my interest in teenagers. I'm sort of... Yeah, I'm just completely fascinated by how one fad can stick in their minds for, you know, 2 years and then it's dead and gone.
Right. Well, so, that's popular culture.
Yeah.
You know, in our time, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, the other thing that I was sort of intrigued by was the old magicians in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of undercurrent of... I guess that kind of brings you into the whole history of magic and this 19th century vision of what magic was like. I thought maybe there was a place you could go with them, you know, somewhere like a side story or something.
That's interesting. Actually, you know, in earlier drafts, I'd written a whole backstory for the leader of the elder magicians. It just didn't seem to, it slowed down the plot a little bit, but that really, their whole presence in the story came from when I started to research magic a little bit more.
And
right. there is sort of a angry undercurrent to magic, I think. I think, at least for me, if I were a magician, I'd be incredibly frustrated by the limitations of my power. And you know, I wanted to sort of explore what it must be like to be frustrated by your inability to actually manipulate the world, something you pretend to do every day.
And they were almost like superheroes in that Neil Gaiman's American Gods, where as long as you believe in them, not heroes, superheroes, but more like gods,
yeah.
that in order to for their magic to work, people mm-hmm. have to believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, and they have to, also the reader has to, at a certain level, suspend disbelief that, you know, what these men say they can do, they can they can do or they could have done
in
this case.
And that's the nature of illusion.
Exactly.
But also kind of ties you into the history of alchemy and the transformation of reality, which is metaphorical and spiritual and not just physical.
Well, there was a whole – I also did a small amount of research of into alchemy, and I think also in an earlier version had used it as a explanation, but – what I realized is you can't really explain the things that I'm writing about.
Better not to.
Yeah, exactly. Because if I did, every time I tried to sit down and write out how these illusions were possible, I realized that it was beside the point. And when you read other books about magicians, like Carter Beats the Devil, or which are about traditional magicians, those books also don't explain. You know, you can't explain what goes on behind stage. So.
Right.
I really wanted to not have a logical or even present explanation.
Well, but that's, I think, in a way, the nature of fiction. That it is, fiction is a form of magic, and that you allow people have to enter your world. So if it's all reality-based, it's not fiction. It's not transformative.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I think that's what was so great about this book, is that it just... you kind of dance around the reality. You know, you allow people, the reader can enter that world as far as he or she wants to go. And I think that's the essential part of art, that you're transforming the reality that we live in to something else. So, you know, you did a great job.
Thanks. I also felt that in the female character, Mel, it was important for her to have some agency in the magical realism, because otherwise it was a huge imbalance of power. So I wanted to bring a different level of magic into her life.
Right. Well, she has the ability to hear fabric in a way that, you know, was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You want to describe that a little bit?
Yeah. She has a very heightened sense of fabric, and... you know, I think that people who work with artists or people who work with certain mediums often have a higher relationship to them, which is it can never quite explain it. So her relationship with fabric transcends anything that I've noticed in anyone who's, you know, an artist. But she can hear certain fabrics sing to her or speak to her. And they basically have personalities, and they allow, and it goes so far as that she is more of a medium for their personalities, and they are translated through her fingers into a story.
Right. I notice it's interesting that you said that she needed to have a balance, you know, a power that balanced off the magician. I actually thought, I mean, as I read it, the book was about her, not about him.
Oh, absolutely, it's about her.
And that that she does have, she is the one with the power.
Yeah.
He actually is the one who doesn't understand anything.
Well, I'm happy to say that you understood it perfectly. it's tricky, because when you write a book about a magician, everyone wants to talk about the magician. When I say, well, this book is actually about a textile designer, it sort of raises a few eyebrows.
Right.
But no, it's definitely about her. She's the one who takes the time to understand what his magic means, and also discovers her agency in their life and their relationship, her, you know, powers or skill with fabric. She's sort of in the most, you know, obvious way, she's sort of a powerful Penelope character, because she's weaving this.
Mm-hmm.
She even says it at the beginning, I think.
Right.
She's making this quilt that may or may not, it might tell the story. She might be telling the story to the quilt. So
right, and she, he may be not real.
He might, exactly.
He may be a character in her story, which is sort of how I ended up feeling.
Which might be the reason that they can't, there's no going to be no more exploration of these characters.
Well, because their relationship is over.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we don't want to go there.
Well, it's not exactly over. We'll see.
But in a certain way, she finishes it.
They finish, yeah.
Yeah. And I, no, it's a terrific story.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I think we could talk, well, you could talk also about some of the other characters. I still want to know more about these old, or the older magicians, you know, whether they're made up in, you know, whether they're her reality or whether they, you know, kind of in the story really exist.
Oh, they definitely really exist. They sort of represent, at least for me, the old-fashioned old guard of magic. I think that in a certain level, magic is terribly old-fashioned. I find it fascinating that people still sign up to go to the theater to see things that are completely unrealistic.
But happily.
And they see it happily. And there, if you read anything about magic, to a certain extent, I'm talking about large-scale illusion, not close-up magic, which is, I think, is much more interesting. Close-up magic, large-scale illusion, it's the same techniques used a lot of the time and just different presentations. So I thought that for magic to evolve, this kind of stagecraft would have to be pushed into the past, and they are very much representative of, you know, an old guard of, you know, misogynist illusions of, you know, all these illusions are, you know, cutting a woman in half, dividing a woman, pushing a woman through a brick wall, shooting
true.
A woman out of a cannon.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know, maybe that time for that sort of had ended. And so that's what their sort of withered ancient state seems to signify to me, at least.
Right. Although your magician main character, your contemporary guy, also is conflicted about how he relates to women.
Yeah, absolutely. But he has been very clear about that he no longer does magic involving people
for no assistance, but because and that maybe does reflect a more modern mm-hmm. view, because when he does the magic with an assistant, something bad happens.
But also for him, magic is personal, and for he's a much more personal relationship to magic. I think the older magicians they want to gain something from it that Toby doesn't.
Right, he's just trying to figure out who he is.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I think it's a terrific book.
Thanks.
Really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll be talking about this book many times
I hope so.
And I just, I recommend this book to a lot of, you know, to every reader. Ivy Pakoda, the author of The Art of Disappearing. It's a wonderful novel. Thank you.
Thank you, David.